Country, you're walking down the fighting side of me. That's the name of this program here on BlakeResistanceRadio.com. Well, lots more news and views for our people, and of course, those are the European founding settler people of the Dominion of Canada, the United States of America, the Dominions of Australia and New Zealand, the Republic of South Africa, Rhodesia, and all of you who may be listening this morning in the European heartland. Well, really, one of the great spirited writers in our movement today is a writer. You can get his writings and you can order his books online. His name is Mike Walsh, and he publishes an online report called This Is Europa. He also has published a number of excellent books, for instance, books like The Rise of the Sun Wheel, Europe Arise, Rhodesia's Death, Africa's Killing Fields, and so on. Anyway, this is a very interesting report on the largely Jewish killers who murdered Tsar Nicholas II and his family in 1918. And they, of course, had been, the Tsar had abdicated, had been overthrown some months earlier. The royal family was taken to a place called Ekaterinburg in Siberia, held captive, and then murdered. example of the murder of Christians, mass murder of Christians, by what was largely, not entirely, but largely Jewish Bolshevism. And this is his report. An ethnic European exclusive ignored by Western media. A remarkable mass march of tens of thousands wended its way through the great Siberian city of Ekaterinburg in mid-July. Over 60,000 people marched on the day of the brutal murder of the Tsar's family. There were similar processions and pilgrimages held through post-Soviet Russia to commemorate the 101st anniversary of the martyrdom of Emperor Nicholas II and his family, brutally murdered by Jewish Bolsheviks on the night of the 17th of July 1918 in the Apatiev house in the rural city of Ekaterinburg. In this report, there's some beautiful pictures of Orthodox monks pictures and icons of the Tsar's family, the royal family. Memorial events included liturgies and prayers, historical conferences, sacred music concerts, and exhibitions. Tens of thousands of people from across Russia and abroad gathered in Ekaterinburg for this annual event. And I certainly agree with Mike Walsh, almost completely unreported in the Western press. Well, why? Who committed the murder? These murders? They were not Irishmen. The main event of the Tsar of the Tsar's days is the Divine Liturgy, which is held at the Church of the Blood, built on the site of the Ipatiev House on the night of July 16. This was followed by a religious procession in the early morning hours of July 17, from the Church of the Blood in Ekaterinburg to the Monastery of the Holy Royal Martyrs at Ganina Yama, which is about 12 miles away. There's a picture there of Kirill, Patriarch of Moscow and all Rus, the supreme leader of the Russian Orthodox Church. In 2012, for the first time since the consecration of the church on the blood, the church of the blood in Ekaterinburg, an all-night vigil and night divine liturgy were performed in the open air. In 2018, again ignored by mainstream Western media, more than 100,000 pilgrims from across Russia and around the world took part in the patriarchal liturgy and the procession of the cross from the church on the blood to Ganina Yama Monastery. An interesting footnote of history was a revelation of the karma visited upon those individuals who in 1918, directly or indirectly, slaughtered the heads of the Romanov dynasty, which had ruled Russia for 300 years, from 1613 through to 1917. Ipatiev House was a merchant's house in Ekaterinburg, later renamed Sverdlovsk under the Russian Soviets, where the former Emperor Nicholas II of Russia, who ruled from 1868 to 1918, who lived from 1868 to 1918 and who reigned from 1894 to 1917, in other words, a 23-year-old reign. His family and members of his household were executed in July 1918, following the Bolshevik Revolution. Its name is identical with that of the Ipatiev Monastery in Kostroma, from where the Romanovs came to the throne. As an act for the 60th anniversary of the Russian Revolutions, it was demolished in 1977 by the orders of the Politburo of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union to the local Communist Soviet government, almost 59 years after the Romanov family's execution and 14 years before the dissolution of the Soviet Union. The priest reminded those gathered, quote, "On this terrible and holy place where the blood of the Tsar, sovereign, God's anointed, and his family was shed, it was here where the most terrible crime of the 20th century took place, that the temple of blood grew. This out of death came life." The breathtaking prophecy. The word of God spoke to us all. "I will create church and gate, and no one will overcome it. Indeed, the blood of the holy martyrs became the holy seed for the church, and the temple which grew up in this place makes a call to repentance. And the Lord saying that he will create the church and the gate, and no one will overcome it, testify to this, that there will be a battle against the church. There will be war, but the church will be invincible and will stay until the second coming." This is what the prophecy was. But those who rebelled against the church and rebel to this day remain miserable, as we see what happened. We know from the history that after the arrest of the Tsar, civil strife, civil war, artificial famine, repression, gulags, Suvorky camp, and much more came. And then the Second World War came, which killed another 20 million Russians. And the people who were in Leningrad, were the first to rebel against the Tsar, and they carried posters, "Down with the Tsar." Then they experienced a terrible famine during the war years, the siege of Leningrad, from September 1941 to January 1944. And this is the torment and death during war, probably also echoes of what happened during the revolution. The case is known, as in the years of the Soviet Union, that there was when there was a putsch in Hungary. Soviet tanks and paratroopers successfully suppressed this putsch. The leaders of the country of Hungary, a well-known participant in the execution of the royal family, believe it or not, leader of Hungary during the rebellion, Imre Nagy, 1896 and 1958, was tried and convicted and executed. And he was the head of state when he was tried in court. And when he was charged and before his execution, he spoke addressing the people in his last words. Do not feel sorry for me. I'm a terrible criminal. I participated in the execution of the Tsar. Coincidence or karma? Quote, all those who took part in the slaughter of the Romanovs suffered terrible punishment for their atrocity, for the blood of the royal family, and for the blood of a fratricidal war. The local Bolsheviks and those who were far from Yekaterinburg but gave the orders to kill the royal family, they all died, some from typhoid, some from the hands of their party members who were killed or executed. And these are people like Sverdlov, the Jewish Trotsky, who of course was really Lev Davidovich Bronstein, Yurovsky, and others. The storm passed over them, eventually destroying the Bolsheviks. I find some of these, what happened to the people who did these terrible things, rather satisfying and interesting. So this is a piece written by Mike Walsh. And that was it. Extremely good write-up by Mike. Always appreciate his writings, and go online and maybe give him some support. He writes excellent books. Here's another one of his books, Trotsky's White Negroes, The Censored Megacost by Mike Walsh. Well, this is Paul Fromm, and you're on the funny side of me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Another interesting, I was getting really good stuff from my good friend Stan Hess. Stan lives down there in the state of Idaho, and I was just about to read this, and how has he gone and disappeared? If you give me just a minute here. Oregon has filed an initiative to restrict self-defense. I mean, there are times when you think that there's a substantial element of absolutely, virtually, certifiably crazy people living in the state of Oregon. My very slow system tries to call that up. I'm going to go to another item. The case of a... I'm looking at a picture of this creature. Freak doesn't quite capture it. maybe close, but it isn't quite. This is a transgender Jessica Yaniv, who's a male but presents as a female. I'm sorry, who is a male but thinks it's a female, still has a penis, and has filed dozens of complaints with the Human Rights, British Columbia Human Rights Tribunal, against aestheticians. These are beauty technicians. And his beef is that at least the ones he's complained against, 16 at latest count. Once they found out they would be dealing with a man, they refused to provide what's called a Brazilian wax, that is the removal of hair in the testicle region and the penis region, because they said they were uncomfortable. Most of them were operating from their own home. They were uncomfortable working on essentially a man. The Brazilian body wax removes the hair in the genital area of women, usually for beauty's sake, wearing quite brief bikinis. Okay, this, I think most people would see this as completely in bad faith, and this is the commentary by Rex Murphy in the July 20th, the National Post, and he points out that the Universal Declaration of Human Rights was adopted in 1848. And the significance for human safety and dignity were then underlined by the revelations of the degrading torments and horrors of the Soviet gulags under communism. And this was provided a canvas of what a world would look like without human rights. It's perhaps the saddest story in the world that since the proclamation, so many states have practiced and are practicing, Cambodia yesterday, North Korea and China today, terrible incursions on the pure dignity and liberty that belongs to every single human being. It's also sad that the idea of human rights has become so degraded and trivialized where is this noble idea now, particularly in the comfortable and secure West, in this era of high progressivism? In British Columbia, there's the present moment of 16 human rights complaints. Launched by a single person who asserts the status of a trans woman against mainly immigrant female cosmeticians who, from religious sensibilities, reasons of safety, or simple personal preference, refuse that person's demand for a Brazilian waxing of their male genitals. Actually, Rex Murphy says there. I guess this is a bit of a tip of the helmet to political correctness, where you are supposed to adopt their in their own self-identification. So if they think they're a male, this is confusing. If they think they're a female, even though they're biologically a male, then you must refer to them as her, or maybe there. we are really in the world of madness, and we are really in the world of madness. But anyway, I'll skip over that because I think I know where he's going with this. Do we really want to call this a human rights case? To insist, for example, that a woman perform a waxing on a penis and testicles in her own home when she doesn't wish to, doesn't know how, and has religious objections as well. Actually, we learned about this during the Watcott case back in December. This was already percolating along. And I hope that there would, that some poor aesthetician, rather than face a case like this, because actually it's a shakedown for money, rather than face a case like this, would decide, fine, Okay, I'm going to close my eyes and I will give this creature who presents. I mean, free. It doesn't quite capture it. There's this short, frizzy, blonde hair. The appearance of something like a bust. A big, beefy shoulders. She's wearing a... Or it's wearing, I guess you call it a halter top dress. Anyway, this is a shakedown. I've digressed a moment. What I kind of hope might happen would be that some poor frightened esthetician would actually say, okay, that you rather than face legal consequences for this, I'll tell you, I'm not skilled at doing this, but you know, if you want to really insist, okay, I will. But if she ends up nicking or cutting freak, well then too bad. Ouch. Anyway, that has not occurred so far as far as we know. Rex Murphy continues, I seriously wonder, if this story somehow made it to the ears of an incarcerated and tortured North Korean, how he would respond to the invocation of human rights law to cover such a matter. How could he, being beaten, doing forced labor on starvation rations, locked in for life, possibly with every family relation in prison too, intellectually or morally digest this, that in some way the cases in BC were being adjudicated under the same rubric of human rights as his situation. I think that this is a very sobering and serious thought. What has happened in much of Canada with this fixation about the so-called rights of the LGBT crowd and the transgender. What's happened? Well, our leaders have frankly lost their way. they have hijacked a perfectly valid matter, a valid concern, human rights, and created rights that in no so-called rights that in no possible way exist. That are a mockery of other real rights. And in the case of another transgender, this is the self-promoting Ronan Ogier in British Columbia to assert his rights not to be criticized about his transgenderism or his sexual confusion. The religious rights of others, like Bill Watcott, who criticized Mr. Ogier when he ran for election in the British Columbia provincial election of 2017, he was complained against, and in a devastating ruling, the British Columbia Human Rights Tribunal slapped him with $55,000 in fines and punishments for having written critically of this creature Ogier's transgenderism during the election. So both his free speech rights or political rights to comment and his religious rights to have a belief and this is the important thing, proclaim that belief were just jackbooted by the BC Human Rights Tribunal in its decision earlier this year. This is, of course, is a mockery of basic human rights. Basic human rights, your right to your religious views and the right to proclaim them. This is the rub. Sanctimoniously, acutely, lawyers for the tribunal, I'm sorry, lawyers for the complainant, Ogier in British Columbia, and interveners on his behalf said, well, of course,
Mr. Watka is entitled to his bigoted religious beliefs, and is entitled to express those beliefs to others of his persuasion in private.
Yeah, that would still be true in private. But in public, apparently not. Because they violate the rights to his dignity of this creature, Ronan Ogier, with a penis, born a male, now thinking he's a female. And I've said before, you see pictures of Ogier with big thick lips and with lipstick and earrings and clearly masculine sort of face, despite a female hairdo and a dress and what looks like the beginning of a bust. Somebody who presents like that, I have said, and I continue to say, nothing that Bill Watcott could ever have said about him damages his dignity any more than the way he behaves. I think Rex Murphy makes an extremely good point. Somebody who really has had their fundamental human rights violated, let's say a political prisoner in North Korea, tortured, starved half to death, forced to perform difficult physical labor. His rights to freedom, perhaps, he's probably in jail for something he said, his political rights, his free speech rights, all grossly trampled. And to think in some way the transgendered in British Columbia and in other parts of Canada, although I don't think it's gone quite that far, are in any way comparable. We've lost our way. Well, it isn't so much that we've lost our way. Our corrupt cultural Marxist leaders, enthralled to the culture of death, that is the LGBTQ lobby, have lost their way. And we are being forced to approve and adopt the worldview of the LGBTQ. For instance, by having to play in their mentally disturbed sandbox of identity. Back to the case of this Jonathan Yaniv. Now, Jonathan Yaniv is the transgender, now trying to look like a woman with the genitalia of a man. Let me proceed, writes Rex Murphy, to another point. The litigant in this case, while posting under his masculine name, Jonathan Yanni, put this up. And this is an interesting comment. This is the first time I've heard this. We have a lot of immigrants here who gawk, judge, and aren't the cleanest of people. They're also verbally and physically abusive. That's one reason I joined a girls' gym, because I don't want issues with these people. They lie about shit. They'll do anything to support their own kind and make things miserable for everyone else. Not quite clear whether he's talking only about the transgendered or other people. But. So, says Rex Murphy, we have a human rights tribunal. We have at a human rights tribunal a person who speaks of ethnic immigrants, particularly women, as dirty and abusive, and calls them these people. That they lie, quote, support their own kind, and that person is the complainant. And, I mean, there certainly is a clean hands issue here. Now, some of this weirdo's views, I think, actually ring partly true. Yes, it's only white people. Now, he didn't say that. I'm saying this. It's only white people who have been so beaten down that we tend not to support our own kind. We tend to adopt the interests of other groups. Every other group,
brazenly and actually quite healthily supports its own people. We're the only ones who are encouraged not to even think of our people as having interests. But anyway, this complainant, Yaniv, is also the person who most vilely went after Lindsay Shepherd, who recently became a mother, with a series of disgusting and most vulgar tweets. They are desperately ugly references to Shepherd's own genitals and reproductive organs. When Shepherd responded with total justified harshness, she was banned from Twitter. Twitter is the slop pail of political correctness. The idea it has immoral authority to rule on anything is benighted. I certainly agree with that. And I've dealt with the Lindsay Shepherd issue in the past few days, where Lindsay was attacked by Yaniv. And Lindsay has a gynecological problem that made it way more difficult for her to have the child, but she did have the child. And Yaniv completely gratuitously made vulgar comments about her problem. Anyway, Rex Murphy says, back to the main storyline. Some of the women, these were the estheticians in British Columbia whom this creature Yaniv approached for a Brazilian wax, obviously under strain to provide for themselves and their families, have had to close their businesses over all this. The stress they are under because of the human rights complaint is itself something that must be filed under an abuse of human rights. The multiple and savage ironies in this case do not seem to have entered the minds of those arbitrating what I regard as a degrading and narcissistic triviality. It's not that it would be impossible for this Yaniv, if he genuinely wanted the equivalent of a Brazilian wax, that is the removal of hair from penis and the testicle area, couldn't get it. If he couldn't do it himself, that there certainly are practitioners who will do that. It's not as though this service was not available. He appears he hit on several dozen female estheticians, primarily to be able to launch human rights complaints and shake them down. Several have settled out of court with him. This is an outrage. The largest of these ironies has to be the publicly expressed disdain and contempt for immigrant women by the person filing complaints, because that person insists it is necessary to be blunt, they handle male genitals. Well, why should any female be required to handle male genitals, except perhaps as a doctor? Originally, and this is the final point, the bizarre proceedings were under a publicity ban. Thankfully, the ban was challenged and is now lifted, and reports from inside the proceedings are available on internet feeds. Imagine, the tribunal was initially going to do all of this behind closed doors, but that is increasingly the behavior of the people's court, and that's really what these tribunals have become, are in fact so-called human rights tribunals. My question to the BC Human Rights Tribunal is simple. Have you no idea of balance, discretion, or plain sense? Serial complaints against struggling women forbidden by their religion or good taste, or how's this, modesty, from waxing a penis and testicles are admitted for deliberation and judgment under the banner of human rights? Questions Rex Murphy. If a day comes when we in the West are judged by less fortunate people, I think there will be more anger at how precious and silly we became with all our wealth and security. So much of what we engage with is playing with the idea of rights, when others are groaning under real pain in real prisons. In other words, what happens when real human rights are violated? We mock them
with our games. This farce in BC should be terminated. And I think that message should go out to anybody who will listen, if there are any still sensible people in the human rights industry. This joke should be terminated. Well, here is another interesting case, and it involves the Premier of the province of Ontario, who was very righteously angry recently, and about yet another whack job. Okay, we're not supposed to say that, are we? This is a person who was found not guilty by reason of mental defect. Well, he was in a nut house. Oh, we better not say that. A mental facility. Now, despite the fact he committed murder, it was decided after some treatment that he'd be entitled to an unescorted day pass. That means he's loose. Call it what you will. He's loose. Well, he was loose. He just kept on going. Well, actually, not so funny. And when it made it to the international airport, it was actually several weeks before the police actually had much of an alert out for him, and he'd skedaddled back to Red China. Well, this is not what our premier here in Ontario was particularly upset about, at least part of us. I'm not upset he went back to Red China, just as long as we can guarantee that he never comes back again. But the case is just delicious in so many ways, as it points to the near insanity of a dysfunctional society. Ontario's premier vowed Thursday to get answers on how a patient detained at a mental health hospital for killing his roommate managed to flee, calling the man a nutcase. And, you know, why must we beat around the bush? Oh, no, it's not their fault. Well, maybe that's a decision God has to make. But they are a menace. Zebhin Kong, who was found not criminally responsible for the death of his roommate, had been on an unaccompanied trip into the community from the Center for Addiction and Mental Health on July 3rd, when he failed to return, the hospital said. That's how they protect, these institutions protect us from people who were so wacky. And perhaps one should be more sensitive, you know, who were struggling with their illness. But they couldn't actually form a criminal intent. And it was so far out of it that he didn't realize what he was doing when he murdered his roommate. But he's allowed to walk free? No way, Jose. The Center for Addiction and Mental Health said a report of the 47-year-old's disappearance later that day to police, who issued a public notice asking for the public's help in finding the man nearly 2 weeks later. And so it took them 2 weeks to get around to, and we've got this whack job running around, or if you've seen him. Kong, who has since fled the country, and police say they are working with international law enforcement agencies to track him down. No, don't. He's not one of ours. Who cares where he is as long as he never comes back? Police have said that the CAHM, that stands for the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, told them Kong presented a low risk to public safety. But the Ontario Review Board, which evaluates the status and assesses the risk of anyone found not criminally responsible, said in its most recent decision in April of this year that he continues to pose a significant threat to society. Premier Ford phoned into a talk show Thursday on News Talk 1010, that's a Toronto radio station, to say he's disgusted. Quote, what is the family thinking of the poor victim that got chopped up with a meat cleaver by this nutcase, and then they let him loose on the streets? Ford said he would be speaking to the Toronto Police, the Review Board, and the Center for Addiction and Mental Health. The Premier sent letters Thursday to the CAH and the police, and Federal Public Safety Minister Ralph Goodale are urging them to conduct reviews. He wrote, "It is vital that your government act to restore the public's trust in the procedures in place to ensure that this never happens again. Mr. Cobb should not have been able to leave the country while detained at the Center for Addiction and Mental Health." Well, I'm not quite sure I agree with him there. He shouldn't have had a choice. He should have been deported. A spokesman for Goodale, that's the Federal Minister of Public Safety, didn't say whether the federal government was looking into the Kong case. No, they don't give a flip. Various other people called for an investigation. Records show that the Ontario Review Board, from the Ontario Review Board, show Kong killed his roommate with a meat cleaver in 2014 and was found not criminally responsible on a charge of second-degree murder. So that's 5 years ago. 5 years later, he's all walking the street on day pass. Toronto Chief of Police says he's going to be doing a review of this, blah, blah, blah. They're all reviewing things. Premier Ford said he would also press the Center for Addiction and Mental Health and the Ontario Review Board, which manages the cases of patients found NCR, that's not criminally responsible or not guilty by reason of insanity, to determine who dropped the ball. Very belatedly on Wednesday, now that the publicity's on them, the Center for Addiction and Mental Health says it'll review its policy regarding patient passes and privileges, and especially unsupervised trips into the community. The announcement came 2 weeks after Mr. Kong's disappearance. Yeah, they were just hoping it would probably pass over. The incident highlights the challenges of managing the rights of people not declared not criminally responsible, but the need to maintain community safety. Yeah, you think? Hours after Mr. Ford's radio interview, the Center for Addiction and Mental Health Chief Executive Officer Catherine Zahn said, "It's clear that there is still work to be done to address misperceptions surrounding mental illness, as well as the prejudice and discrimination faced by those who live with mental disorders." And I wrote, I don't usually say this on air, but I don't think there's any other word that captures it. Horseshit. It's, what's the issue according to the head of this agency that let this loony loose? It's clear that there's still work to be done to address misperceptions surrounding mental illness, as well as the prejudice and discrimination faced by those who live with mental disorders. Prejudice and discrimination. Well, maybe reasonable fear. Reasonable fear. To discriminate means to choose. If you decide I will wear my red tie to the meeting tonight rather than my blue tie, you're choosing, you're discriminating. And that's not wrong. She self-righteously goes on to say, "I suspect the Premier on reflection understands the inappropriateness of that." Inappropriate. I hate that politically correct word. I'll tell you why. Because it's vacant, vacuous, empty. It doesn't tell me anything except that the person uttering it disapproves. There's nothing inappropriate for what he said. This man is insane. Or at least was insane. Whether he is today or not, we don't know. He was ruled insane, and he's being allowed loose. Mr. Kong, 48, had been detained at the Center for Addiction and Mental Health since 2016 after killing another boarder in his rooming house. He was diagnosed with schizophrenia and found NCR, that's not criminally responsible or not guilty by reason of insanity. So he's been in there for 3 years. I guess he was in prison up until that time, and until his trial. The article goes on further to say, well, it's unclear where Mr. Kong went. He had long expressed a desire to return to his home country of China to live with his mother. His command of the English language is poor, and he showed little interest in integrating into life in Canada, according to the ORB decision. Forensic patients at the Center for Addiction and Mental Health are allowed access to computers, money, and phones. It's not clear whether Mr. Kong had a passport in his possession at the facility. He wanted to return to China. Why was he not returned to China? What was he doing here in the first place? Now, notice his command of the English language is poor, and he showed little interest in integrating into the community. What was he doing here? How did he ever get in? That's a very good question. Farther in the article, it says, Mr. Kong had not obtained a permanent residency card or signed the housing application. The decision noted that without a permanent residency card, Mr. Kong may be deported to China. So, what is his status in Canada? What is his status? Well, he should have been deported because he committed murder. Well, this is Paul Fromm. You're on the fighting side of me. Let me play a few songs by Hank Williams Jr. Always like Hank. Why don't we play? This is one of his signature songs. I don't know where this thing disappeared to. We're having our technical problems, aren't we? Anyway, this is Hank Williams Jr. Hope you like it. Paul Fromm, you're on the fighting side of me. You're on White Resistance Radio with your car.
Your forecast.
Hank Williams Jr. Song that kind of humorous about Hank Williams Sr.
Don, tell us how it really was when you was working with Daddy.
Well, in 1950, I took a little nip along with Mr. Williams on the way to Mississippi. We were stacked knee deep in a Packard limousine when we met this promoter in the town of New Orleans.
Well, a man told Daddy he had what it took, and he liked the way it sang, and he liked the way it shook.
He said pretty soon he'd make us all rich.
Believing that's bad, so I'm big. Now, Daddy told a man if you want to make some dough, take a little money and
Well, this is Paul Fromm, your own fighting side of me, back with you again tomorrow, same time, midnight Eastern time. The show is repeated at 8 in the morning, 4 in the afternoon. All of those are Eastern Standard Time. And I sign off tonight, as I always do, with the anthem of the real Canada, the Maple Leaf Forever.
In days of yore, from Britain's shore, Wolfe the dauntless hero came and planted firm Britannia's flag on Canada's fair domain. Here may it wave our boast, our pride, and joined in love together. The thistle, shamrock, rose entwine, the maple leaf forever. The maple leaf, our emblem dear, the maple leaf forever. God save our queen and heaven bless the maple leaf forever. Heights and Lundy's Lane, our brave fathers side by side for freedom, homes and loved ones dear, firmly stood and nobly died. And those dear rights which they maintained, we swear to yield them never.